All right, so for those of you who haven't been around, we are going through the Old Testament, as it's kind of labeled here, like Old Testament survey. So kind of the idea is getting that kind of flyover view a little bit of the various books of the Bible. Okay, so we're slowly working our way through. Last fall, we did Genesis through Deuteronomy and kind of through that 8 weeks. And this semester, in the bulletin, I think David announced like it was Joshua through Malachi, so finishing the Old Testament, which that wasn't David's fault. I actually put that. But as you learned from me last time, that might be ambitious. So that's why I put just question marks instead on my actual slides here. So we'll see kind of how far we get over these 12 weeks. But the goal is to finish the Old Testament, but we'll see. And there's just that tension that I balance of wanting to move through, but not too quick, okay? And you might be thinking, how are you not going too quick sometimes? But yeah, like, so as you'll get used to it, we go kind of fast, okay? So in our services, adult Sunday school, we go a little bit slower, kind of the verse by verse, all that. But kind of our pattern in these classes is to get kind of the overview and then kind of dive into different sections, then come back out and keep going. Okay, so that's kind of the idea of these classes. Okay, we're kind of in new territory here. All right, so we were in the Torah, Genesis through Deuteronomy, and now we are entering Joshua. Okay, so you have your kind of handouts there. Again, that's just kind of like the outline and just room for you to write whatever notes you want, or just a resource in that way. Okay. But as we think of like our introduction to Joshua, this again is going to be a little different than what we've been encountering with the Torah, with the Pentateuch, Genesis through Deuteronomy, because remember, we only had to do kind of one introduction, and that was good for all those five books because you had kind of the same author, a lot of that stuff, Moses writing all those things, and now we have kind of some things to actually talk about here with each of these books. Okay, and so we are moving out of the Torah into like in our kind of the Protestant canon and stuff is what we call like the historical books. Okay, the historical books. And then in the Hebrew kind of canon, this is the section called like the Nevi'im or the prophets. Okay, if you remember, like the Tanakh is sometimes what the Old Testament is referred to. It's the Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. Okay, so like the law, the prophets, and the writings is kind of what it is. So we're entering now the prophets, and Joshua is part of this kind of the former prophets, is what they kind of say. All right. So as we kind of go through, title of the book, just simply, any guesses of where we get Joshua from? Yes. Oh, yeah. So we get the title Joshua from obviously one of the main characters of this book. This title is the same in the English canon, as well as like the Hebrew canon, all that, which again is kind of a departure. If you remember in the Torah, Genesis through Deuteronomy, the first kind of word or phrase, the main phrase, was kind of the title of the book. Okay, but now we're kind of departing from that to where it's just Joshua. Okay, and really the name Joshua means the Lord saves, delivers, and is fitting as you kind of think of what's going on in the book of Joshua with the conquest and everything. You see the Lord's hand involved in all of that. He's the one delivering. He's the one saving through all that. And just on a side note, in Greek, this is like the equivalent of Jesus. Okay, so that's the same kind of name. So Jesus, that's the Hebrew is really Joshua, actually. Yeshua is that. Okay. All right. Authorship. And so, again, we're now in a book that we don't just get to say Moses and move on, right? But now we have some thoughts of, okay, well, who wrote this book? And I don't know, any guesses? Yeah, traditionally, like, people consider Joshua as the author, okay? Very positive. We don't know for sure because it doesn't say, like, in the Bible and all that. But kind of traditionally, that's what's been held is Joshua. Some, like, kind of extra biblical, like Jewish sources, like the Talmud or other things, kind of recognize Joshua as the author. And that's a pretty good option, or at the very least, it's likely someone who was an eyewitness to these events. Okay, someone who was an eyewitness to all these things, because you see a lot of the details involved with like the troops, the amounts of people, you know, the as the dividing of the land, all the exact measurements, all these different things, like very likely that it would be an eyewitness to this, right? And you even have like in chapter 5, like the first person being used. And so it seems like someone kind of there potentially, right? Or it says like us or we, right? And so kind of the idea. And even in Joshua 24, it kind of references Joshua writing some things down. And so there's a possibility that at least part of it is him, if not the majority of this, okay? But you also have some things at the end of Joshua that we'll get to that kind of recount things that happened like after his life. And so maybe someone else who was an eyewitness, all that kind of fills that in and all that. But largely to say, probably the majority would be Joshua, okay? Or at least another eyewitness to all this, okay? Someone, maybe like one of the priests or something might have filled in, like Phineas at the end. Could be some of that as well, okay? All right. And then the date. And obviously, like, the date kind of ties into who you think the author is. So if it's you think it's Joshua, it's going to be around his lifetime. Okay, but some people try to place this as written later, like during the kind of monarchy and the time of David and different things like that. For various reasons, they try to do that. But I don't think that's the case, okay? And we're going to talk about how if Joshua is the author, as we're suggesting, then this was written shortly after all these events took place, okay? Because he doesn't live like a whole lot longer after that. And so the question is, well, when did these events take place? When did the conquest, kind of the main section of this book, when did that all take place? And so if you remember back in our discussion of the book of Exodus, so I'm going to be referring back to the Torah a lot, so I'm going to test you guys what you remember. Because as if you remember, right, the Torah I kept saying was it was foundational to a lot of scripture, and you're going to see that play out, right, today. Right away in Joshua, puts you to the test. And so if you remember, we have, like in the book of Exodus, you had kind of some differing views of the actual date of the Exodus, okay? And we talked about a couple ones, like for example, there's what we call like the early date, which would be 1446 BC. And then there's the late date, which I believe is around like 1260, which is around 1260 BC. Okay? So early, late date, do you guys remember which one we kind of held to?
The one Ramses.
Yes, yeah, the one that wasn't Ramses, yeah. It's very true. Find out Prince of Egypt lied to us. Any? It's a 50-50 shot. You got any takers, any bold? Joshua, be bold and courageous.
The later one, $1.
This one?
12 BC.
12? It's actually this one. Close though, close. Yeah. So we held to the early date, okay, the early date of the Exodus, 1446 BC. And so if you remember, how long do they wander in the wilderness for? 40 years, which would then put the start of the conquest at 1406, okay, BC. And traditionally lasts about 7 years. So kind of the events are this 1406 to 1399 BC is really like the conquest at large, like the proper conquest, okay? Because as we'll talk about, the conquest wasn't really finished. There were still like people living in the land and stuff like that. But the main kind of proper conquest, 7 years, 1406 to 1399 BC, okay? All right, so then we would argue that the writing is around that time or shortly after that time, okay, is what is going on here. And to kind of support that, right, you have references in the book of Joshua that wouldn't make sense if it was written later, okay? So you have, for example, one reference you have like to the Jebusites occupying Jerusalem, okay, which they did until like the time of David when they kind of conquered Jerusalem and took that over and became the capital of Israel. And so if someone was writing in the time of David, it seems strange to then write that the Jebusites are occupying Jerusalem, right? Like, and stuff like that. And so there's a couple other items kind of like that, all right? So it kind of argues for this more earlier time being written shortly after the events actually took place. Okay, so around that 1406, 1399, a little bit after that. Okay, all right. And that leads us into the historical context. Okay, that is really tiny. I'm sorry. It's a little tiny thing on the slides, but all right, historical context. So as I mentioned, events taking place there. Let's take a moment to kind of consider what's going on in what we call like the ancient Near East at that time. So what's going on in kind of the area around Canaan, essentially, right? They're going in the land of Canaan. So what's going on with that? And so what you kind of have when you look at the history around that time is that you really have like what we call like a power vacuum in the land of Canaan during this time. Okay, that a lot of the kind of major powers of the time, there's like the Hittites, the Mitanni, Assyria, Egypt, they're all kind of preoccupied with various other things. Okay, for example, like the Hittites, Mitanni, and Assyria, they're kind of occupied with each other, with kind of worrying about them kind of growing and all these different things, so kind of battles back and forth, and so they're more concerned about each other, and so those are all kind of like above in the north, above Israel, and so they're not worried too much about the south, and then even some of them, and even like Syria and stuff like that, like they didn't want to expand too far south because the land of Canaan was technically like in control by like Egypt, and so they didn't want to really provoke Egypt to anything, so they kind of like let that go and kind of like, yeah, we don't really want to provoke Egypt. But it's kind of funny because at that time, the Egyptian pharaoh wasn't really concerned with external affairs. He was much concerned with like hunting and the arts, actually, and stuff. And even the pharaoh after like the conquest and stuff like that a little bit later, he too was also more concerned internally with things like establishing a unified religion and stuff like that. And so really didn't care too much of what was going on. Okay, during that time. And so what ends up happening is what? There's this power vacuum in the land of Israel. And that, what, sets the stage perfectly for the conquest to where it's ripe for the taking, right? And so all that kind of stands in the way are the various, like, Canaanite, Amorite people in the land of Israel, okay, or the land of Canaan at that time. So very much a perfect situation for them to be entering. Again, just shows God's sovereignty in that, right? It's not coincidence, not chance. That's how God orchestrates it for this to happen. Okay? So again, very important, very crucial for that. Another piece of kind of historical context that we'll briefly just talk about here, and we kind of mentioned it back when we talked about like the date of the Exodus and all that back in the Torah, but sometimes people bring up why they want, like, especially like this late date of the Exodus. And a lot of that centers on the conquest, actually, because when they look at some of the archaeological evidence, you tend to look like, for some like a conquest, you would look for what people call like burn layers in cities, which is, as it sounds like, if something was burned to the ground, there'd be kind of this layer of kind of ash and destruction and all that. And you can kind of see that in archaeology of like, oh, around this time, something was destroyed, right? But what people have noticed is, hey, during this time of the conquest, according to like the traditional time, that 1406 to 1399, there's not a whole lot of burn layers around. There's not a lot of destruction that occurred. And so that's why they then try to date it later, okay, to try to make it fit. But if you kind of remember, do you remember what the solution was with that we kind of talked about? Of maybe why you wouldn't expect to find many burn layers throughout? Like why you wouldn't expect to actually find many burn layers from the conquest? Okay, you didn't use fire? Yeah, they didn't. If you remember Deuteronomy, it talks about they actually weren't going to destroy most of the stuff, right? Deuteronomy 6 talks about how you're going to enter this land and you're going to live in houses you didn't build, in cities you didn't build, right? And so most of the conquest didn't actually involve destroying the cities, like leveling the cities, because what? They ended up just like inhabiting them. Okay, so they kind of wiped out the people, but they kind of kept the structures all in place. And so you wouldn't actually expect to find a lot of destruction and burn layers around this time, which again fits kind of the archaeology. Okay? But, as we'll talk about today as well, you had three locations, though, that were kind of totally destroyed, burned to the ground, all that, which was Jericho, Ai, and Hazor. Okay? And what you have is archaeological evidence that fits that those were burned around like that time, right? Or at least Jericho and Hazor. We'll talk a little bit about later because we don't know where that is exactly. But Jericho and Hazor have burn layers that would support that timing. Okay? So the cities that the Bible depicts as being destroyed and burned have the burn layers you'd expect, and all the rest really don't. Okay? So it fits well, even though people might argue, well, there's no evidence of the conquest. It kind of lines up with the biblical record, right? If you understand that. Okay. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Cool. And then the last thing here we need to kind of bring up here, just for, again, historical background, all this, is this issue of these people called the Epeiru. So there's these letters that have been discovered, like in archaeology and all that, known as the Armana letters. Okay, the Armana letters. And what those, and they date back to kind of like this time frame, around that time. And what they are is kind of this correspondence between various kind of Canaanite city-states, like in the land of Canaan, and Egypt. Okay, and most of them kind of asking for Egypt for help, that they're being attacked by these people, and we need help, okay? And again, Egypt was like, well, I'm about the arch right now, so they just kind of ignored them, didn't really do anything with it. But some of these letters mention being attacked by these Epeiru, okay? And sometimes they are called, like, also, like, Habiru, which, what does that kind of sound like? Yeah, Hebrew, okay? And so the question is, are the Epeiru mentioned in these letters actually like the Israelites during the conquest? So when people first found these letters, like people were super excited, like, hey, we have evidence, finally, like the conquest, it's happened, all this stuff, right? But what we kind of find is, are these like the same people as the Israelites? And the answer is yes and no, right? Where sometimes, yes, it seems to line up with the biblical record, but then other times, it is not, and it's clearly not the people of Israel. Like, you have the Epeiru mentioned in conquering lands or doing stuff that Israel was never in, okay? And so, like, there's times where, yes, it's referring to them, and other times it's not, okay? Just to make it nice and confusing for everyone. And that confusion lines, like, is because, like, in the Canaanites' eyes, they seem to kind of lump all of them together as the same people, okay? And so, really, the Epeiru, it's kind of this reference to like a general people group, not even really nationality people. Some people argue that it's more so like maybe like a social class, this like group of kind of wandering mercenaries is kind of this idea. And so it refers to like a broader people. And so sometimes Israel was kind of then lumped in with that, right? Because you suddenly had this group kind of appear and start like kind of destroying things. And they kind of think, oh, that's like the Epeiru, right? And they kind of lump them in together. And so even though they're not like the equivalent, sometimes that was probably referring to them, right? Does that make sense? So a little bit. Yeah, it's confusing, but that's, yeah, what it is, right? So just so you're aware, right? Just so you have that. Again, we get this historical context. So if you ever hear about any of that, right, there's some background with that. But again, that kind of helps support still kind of the historicity of these accounts, right? Because some of those things are probably the Israelites going, like, and attacking, and you have these Canaanites reaching out to Egypt at that time, like, hey, stuff's going down, help us, and all that. So again, ties in with the biblical narrative pretty well, okay? All right, so that's historical context. All right, so theme of the book. So I like to give kind of a general theme here of what is going on and everything. And again, really, every book of the Bible is telling us something about God. Okay, that's really, he is the main character of every book of the Bible. And so what do we see about God here? And so the theme we're kind of going with here is the God who conquers. Okay, the God who conquers. And you're like, well, that makes sense. Conquest, conquers, yeah. And so what you're going to see, though, as you understand that God is a conqueror and is waging kind of this holy war on sin, you'll start to understand more of who he is and where things are heading. Okay, and Joshua really introduces this concept to us. And so as the book unfolds, you have obviously like the conquest taking place. That makes sense. And Israel conquering the land. But it's only through who that they are doing this? The Lord, right? It's only through the Lord. And so what you're going to see is he has the power to claim dominion over everything. Okay, the promised land is essentially just like a small microcosm of the fact that, like, yeah, he owns that land, but he also what owns everything, right? He owns everything. And what you're going to see as God like gets Israel to land, he's getting them there for a purpose, right? He's getting them there for a purpose, and that purpose is to put his agenda on display. And you're like, well, what agenda is that? And that is that he owns everything. Everything in creation is to point to his glory, right? That's what we even saw revealed in like the Pentateuch and stuff, the Torah with Genesis and creation. All that is supposed to point to his glory. But then you're going to encounter another issue in here because Israel is what? Sinful. And they can't really complete God's agenda. And so as you end the book of Joshua, and especially as you enter into like the book of Judges, which we'll see next time, is that even though God's plan is continuing, Israel can't really handle the plan, right? Israel can't handle the plan, and that's going to result in everything going into kind of a crisis. And eventually what's going to happen is, how do you solve that crisis? What do you need? And you need what? A king. Okay, you need a king. And do you guys remember back in our Torah stuff, where did we see the mention of a king before? Testing you guys. I know it's been like 2 months. So yeah, it's fine. It's fine. It's not like last week, but yeah. If you remember, what we had like Genesis 49:10, right? The prophecy of the one who would come from the line of Judah, who would bring peace. Shiloh, who would come, and he would have the ruler's staff. Right? He'd be part of that kingly line, and that connected back to like Genesis 3:15, the one who would, the seed who would crush the head of the serpent, all that. And so really God's plan is coming full circle, right? To essentially, you're going to see at some point, like, you need a king to resolve this, right? And it's paving the way for the true king to come. All right. So that ties into that. And so in building off this a little bit is you then also start to develop what some people call like a conquest theology. Okay, a conquest theology throughout scripture. And it shows that God really does own this world, not just the promised land. He owns everything. And as I mentioned before, what you have to understand, and we're going to see, is that the conquest starts in Joshua, but it's never really finished. All right, it's never actually finished. They didn't actually conquer the land. It's not completed yet. And instead, what you see as you go through scripture is that it's not going to be fully completed until what ends up happening? Jesus returns, right? Like even future to us today, right? That Jesus returns, conquering everybody, everything, and makes all things right, okay? And so Joshua kind of starts that, but it's not going to finish until like Revelation 19, right? Where Christ comes back riding the white horse and all that, okay? Okay, and that's kind of confirmed, right, a little bit, because if you even think about, like, the book of Revelation, as you have, like, some of the judgments that are poured out on the world during that time, you have things like hailstones and stuff raining down, you have water turning to blood, all that. What does that make you think of? Plagues. Yeah, the plagues of Egypt, right, connecting with, like, the Exodus, and then at the end of Revelation, you have what? Jesus riding in the white horse, wiping people out, conquering. What's that make you think of? Conquest, right? That's conquest imagery there. And so that is what is going to finish. And Revelation 19 is the final conquest. Okay, that is the final conquest. All right. And then kind of tied in with all this, this idea of conquest and everything, you have to understand it also connects with this idea of rest. Okay, so there's kind of a purpose to this conquest. And so even like Joshua in chapter 1, verse 13, it talks about the Lord is providing you a place of rest. Okay, there's this idea of rest connecting back. And even Joshua 23 ends with this, again, reminder of rest. And again, I'm just putting you guys on the spot all over. Where did we see this idea of rest before? Yeah, all the way back in creation, right? You saw it with like Noah that like God would give rest, but then even before that, in creation, right? The Sabbath rest, the seventh day, the day of rest, right? And that day was what? Essentially like to point creation, point things back to God and to bring glory and honor to him, right? That's kind of the idea and all that. And so the way to get back to this Sabbath rest is through conquest. Okay, so God's agenda is continuing to move forward. It is continuing to move forward and will be finalized when Christ returns and accomplishes this final conquest to usher in the final rest. Okay, making all things right. Okay, that is what we have to see here, this connection with rest, that everything will be made right. And in part of that is as God conquers, this is not just in like a spiritual sense. Okay, I think we sometimes very much think that God just works in that spiritual way. And yes, he does. Like there is that element. But part of this also connects with, in a physical sense as well. Okay, he is working on a physical level as well as a spiritual level. Okay, he is actually dealing with this world. Okay? And so we need to understand that, right? Because I think sometimes like when people look at like the conquest and they read about it and stuff like that, some people have very negative thoughts on it and they kind of wonder like, well, how could this good God kind of wipe out all these people? How can this good God do all these things? But what you have to understand, like how do you make wrong right? You need to judge it. You need to judge it. And what you see in Joshua is that God will judge. Okay? And one professor I had like kind of point out something interesting about here, like why this seems to bother people so much is because when you think about it, when Jesus returns, like in Revelation conquers, like no one seems to have an issue with that, right? Even though like in reality he's like wiping out a ton of people, right? But no one really bats an eye at that. But when they read like Joshua and stuff, they're like, well, that sounds bad. Like, why is God doing this? Like, why is he, why are these people being killed and all that? And I think the issue that kind of professor brought up is because we all like the idea of the bad guy being punished, right? That's why we watch movies and stuff and we're like, yeah, they got the bad guy, right? Like it happened, they did it. And when they don't, it's like not satisfying. You're like, I got away with it, right? But what Joshua reminds us of is that the bad guys aren't just necessarily the bad guys over there, right? The bad guys, right, are just people that look innocent, just like who? You and me. And that's what doesn't sit well with people, right? Because it starts to hit a little too close to home, right? And that's what people don't like when they find out what? They're the bad guy, essentially, right? And so Joshua reminds us of this, that, yeah, God is working in the physical sense as well, not just the spiritual, it's physical. And this is all going to, again, culminate in the final conquest in the end, okay? But what Joshua will show is God's dominance over all creation, and we're continuing to head towards him making all things right. Okay, that's what we're introduced here. All right, so all that's under our theme of the book. We're, like, never going to finish this. Okay, so structure of the book. So structure of the book here. So you have a little outline there on your sheet, just kind of simple way to think about it, of them all related to kind of the land, them entering the land in the first few handful of chapters, then conquering the land, dividing the land. That's like kind of the portioning out, not like creating divisions all right, like portioning out, and then kind of settling in the land. All right, so that's what outline we're going to kind of go with here. All right, so let's get in to Joshua itself. Okay, so all that to say, now we're actually in Joshua. Let's get to it. So entering the land, chapters 1 through 5, the first part of 5, and all that. And so what we see in chapter 1 is that God establishes his leader. God establishes his leader. And so really we are picking up right where the Torah left off, because do you remember what kind of happened at the end of Deuteronomy?
Moses died.
All right, Moses died. So kind of an end of an era there. But notice something significant here. As you come onto the scene with Joshua, who's kind of like the main one on the scene? Who's the one doing the action, the talking here? Who is it? Verse 1. Yeah, God. The Lord is. Okay? He is the main character, right? Joshua is obviously an important character, all that. But God, as I mentioned, is the main character of everything. And what we see here, that even when leadership changes, and that's not always easy, who is still ultimately in control? It's God. He's the constant. He's still moving and driving everything forward, okay? And so, And so, as we go through here, right, there's an emphasis here in the first chapter of the Lord being with Joshua and with Israel in this context, okay? In context, conquest, okay? But this concept of the Lord being with them shouldn't really surprise us, because do you remember back in Genesis, when we talked about like the patriarchs, like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all that, like how we talked about they were forming foundational truths of like the nation. And one of those with Jacob and Isaac was the reality that God is with his people. Okay, and that's what you see unfolding again here in Joshua. That there's this emphasis all throughout this chapter of, I'm going to be with you. Okay, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to be with the people. Like, this is how this is going to be successful, is because God is with them. And really, apart from the Lord, then what? They would completely fail. As we'll actually get a glimpse of that as well in Joshua. Okay, and so that's the only reason, right, that this should work. Okay, if you think of the conquest and you think of Israel, like, this never should have worked, right? This never should have worked. They weren't like the trained special elite soldiers, right, coming in and wiping out people, right? They're just kind of the farmers, shepherds, all that coming in from Egypt, ragtag group of people, and yet it works. Okay, it works. All right, and so you have in here this call that God will be with them. And do you remember what he calls Joshua to, like, be? It's kind of that famous thing.
Courageous.
Yeah, to be strong and courageous, right? To be strong and courageous. But notice in verses like 7 and 8, what is that being strong and courageous, like, connected with? Like, doing what? Yeah, doing what Moses told me to do. Like, so obedience, right? Obedience to the law, obedience to the word of God. And so what we're getting at all the way in chapter 1, right, is that it's not going to be through like their might or through their military strategy or all this stuff that they are going to succeed and be prosperous, but rather it'll only be through obedience. It'll only be through obedience. And this is crucial for Israel to understand, because when they don't obey, when they disobey, then what? Failure will follow. Okay, so it's all about God, right? The focus is on him, okay? All right, and then Joshua instructs the leaders to get the people ready to pass over the Jordan River. That's kind of how it wraps up. And then, but before they actually do enter the land and everything, chapter 2, we have kind of this familiar story, I'm sure, to a lot of you, of Rahab and the spies. In this chapter, okay? So let's point out some things here. First of all, how many spies are sent into Jericho?
12?
Not 12.
14.
Two. Yeah, we had 12 earlier, right? Yeah, we had 12 into the land of Canaan before, okay? And that actually kind of connects, right? Because why do you think they wouldn't maybe send 12 again? Did that go well last time? No, it didn't, right? In fact, right, if you remember, out of the 12, how many were like the good spies that gave a good report?
Two.
So it's almost kind of like, all right, let's just cut to the chase and get the two good ones. We don't need all these other people. Let's just send two this time, because obviously 12 didn't work last time. Let's just send two and all that. Skip the other 10, okay? So they send these two. They enter the city. They end up inside the house of Rahab here. And again, if you know the story, the king finds out, kind of orders, hey, hand over these spies, all that. And what does she do? What does Rahab do?
Hides
them, right? She hides them, doesn't hand them over, hides. Instead, she tells them, like, oh, they escaped just before the gates closed, and you should go chase them down, right? Go hunt them down. They'll find them and all that. And we're not going to get into the issue of, like, oh, was it okay she lied, all that, right? Like, because that's not really, like, the point. All right, that's not the point of the passage, but what's more important for us to focus on is kind of two aspects of this kind of interaction here. First of all, we have confirmation of something that we said back in our study of the Torah. Again, we keep referencing back. Do you remember, like, as they left Egypt and even in their wilderness wanderings, I made the comment that a lot of these things were done to put Israel on display to the nations. You kind of remember that a little bit. And that kind of talked about how nations would probably be sending spies or checking out, like, what's going on with Israel and all that. And that's what we have confirmation of here. Okay, because notice, like, in verse 10 of chapter 2, it says what? For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan. And all that, right? Like, so they're essentially like, we've heard of you, right? We know what's happened. We know about God drying up the Red Sea, you crossing the Red Sea. We know about what you've done in your wilderness wanderings. We've heard of it, okay? And so, again, the Lord's plan of kind of putting himself on display, not only to Israel, but also to the nations, has worked brilliantly, right? It's worked brilliantly. And so to the point where what? She's like, we've heard of it and we're afraid, right? We're afraid of all this, okay? But then the second thing we need to realize with this kind of interaction here, as we see in Rahab's words and actions, is the significance of what she is doing. Because you can ask this question, well, why would she lie? Why would she lie to the king and hide the spies when she could have probably easily just handed them over and got a nice reward, right? For all that, right? She probably been celebrated. Like, you caught the spies. Yeah, like, good job. And all that. But why does she do that?
She feared the Lord.
Yeah, she feared the Lord. She has essentially switched allegiances. She has essentially switched allegiances. She is no longer answers to the king of Jericho, but to who? Yahweh, the God of Israel. Because notice, like, even what she says in, like, verse 11 here. As soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. She recognizes who the one true God is. It is Yahweh. It's not this God of Jericho or whatever they got. Like, it's your God. It is Yahweh. And so she is essentially no longer recognizing herself as, like, a Canaanite. She's recognizing herself as a what? Israelite. She has kind of defected, in a sense, right, over. And so then you can understand kind of even part of this of why she is then called in, like, Hebrews 11, a person of what? Faith. Because she has, been incorporated really already into the people of Israel. And again, you end up seeing, she actually ends up part of the genealogy of who? Jesus, right? So she just, you can understand why she can be incorporated in the people, because what? She has this faith. She's recognized that God is the true God, and that's who I am serving. That's who I am following. All right. And so then the chapter kind of wraps up, like, the spies agreed to, like, protect Rahab and her family, all that, when they come to conquer, that, yes, we'll spare you all that. And they report everything back to Joshua, praising the Lord, and we see God's plan moving forward, and it's working perfectly, right? Working perfectly here. All right. Let's see. So normally we take a break after, like, 40 minutes. You guys want to take a little break real quick? Yeah. All right. So we'll take a few minute break, 5 minute break, and then we'll pick back.